First, I want to apologize. I will not be speaking in French, and I also will not be speaking about the larger context, the global context of prison issues. I know that Americans are known for only talking about themselves and only knowing about themselves. And so it is because I'm a good comparativist. I was not trained to do this, but I am we are capitulating to the moment and to some of the demands here. But I do want to thank our dear friend Mansia Diawara for bringing us both to Florence and to Paris, and also our new friend Nicole Lapierre, and also Francois Vitrani for hosting us here. And Angela has thanked the other organizations, and I won't take the time now to do that. I will try to truncate my remarks because it is very late, and we do want there to be time for questions. So if I can, I'm going to try and compress what I had. She also added some things that I think I might have said, so we'll be able to take some less time.
En guise d'introduction, je voudrais m'excuser de ne pas parler français et également m'excuser parce que je ne vais pas forcément parler d'un contexte global, mais plutôt de la situation et répondre aux demandes qui ont été faites pour ici. Je vais essayer de raccourcir quand même ce que j'avais prévu afin qu'on ait du temps pour les questions.
I do not have the same long history with France that Angela has personally, but I did want to say, because I have a dear friend here in the audience, Avan Zabignon, whom I met in the early 1990s, one of my, I think my first trip maybe to Paris. And so I am always happy to return as well, and especially to be involved in conversations that connect the many issues where we have very specific forms of difference, but where we share some of the current troubles.
Alors, je n'ai pas une histoire aussi longue que celle d'Angela avec la France, mais j'ai tout de même des amis ici que j'ai rencontrés dès le début des années 90. Et je suis toujours heureuse de revenir ici et d'avoir ces conversations sur les différences sociales, etc.
My task is to explain what we mean by abolition feminism, to try and give you some historical context for it, and also to talk about some of its elements. It is primarily a form of feminism that doesn't necessarily go by that name. It is really only to contrast it with what is increasingly being called carceral feminism. The carceral feminism is not recognized either by everyone, including those who are charged with practicing it. However, it is the form of feminism that is described increasingly as being connected to and dependent upon the forms of subjugation that the prison industrial complex makes plain.
Alors, ma tâche aujourd'hui, ça va être de vous expliquer ce qu'est le féminisme abolitionniste, donc en vous donnant des éléments de contexte historique, etc. Et notamment en revenant aussi sur l'idée du coup du féminisme carcéral, qui n'est pas une idée reconnue par tout le monde, mais qui est une forme de féminisme qui prend de l'ampleur.
And some would ask today why we even use the term feminism. I mean, if it is indeed so insufficient in so many ways and so tied to carcerality, then why is it important? Angela has already introduced the movement we call Black Lives Matter, and also the larger framework of the movement for Black Lives, which includes the other organizations. And it is often not apparent, as this movement and the news of this movement travels, that it is at heart a feminist movement. That the reason it is called a leaderless movement, which is sometimes an accusation and sometimes a proud declaration, is that it begins by thinking critically about leadership from a feminist perspective. It is also a movement which mobilizes identity, but in a non-identitarian framework. That is, it is a movement begun by those who were involved in struggles around labor, struggles around immigration, struggles around sexuality and justice. And those are connected to the framework which examines state violence and racism.
Une question qu'on peut se poser, c'est pourquoi utiliser le terme de féminisme dans ce féminisme abolitionnisme. Angela vous a déjà introduit au mouvement Black Lives Matter et au plus grand mouvement pour les vies noires de manière générale. Il y a quelque chose qui n'apparaît pas souvent par rapport à ce mouvement, c'est que c'est en son cœur un mouvement féministe. C'est notamment un mouvement qui a été qualifié de « sans leader » et qui a été qualifié ainsi parfois dans une perspective critique, péjorative. Parce que c'est aussi un mouvement qui est très critique sur ces dynamiques de leadership, qui est critique depuis un point de vue féminisme. C'est un mouvement qui est constitué de personnes qui ont d'abord été engagées dans des luttes aux côtés des travailleurs, des immigrés, de la sexualité, de la justice, et qui étaient connectées au cadre de réflexion du coup, qui réfléchit sur les violences d'État et le racisme.
The term abolition feminism or abolitionist feminism uses the same word that characterizes the movement to end slavery in the United States, of course, and elsewhere in the world, and that is an intended analogy and a reminder of thinking contingently about domination. It was mobilized by those of us who have been challenging what is now called the prison industrial complex, which is, I should say, not the structures and the buildings, but rather the complex of political structures, economics, ideas that hold the prison together and that create it as a solution, an ostensible solution to social problems, which we believe would be better managed in other ways.
Le terme de l'expression de féminisme abolitionniste mobilise du coup un mot qui est commun au mouvement d'abolition de l'esclavage. Cette analogie permet justement de penser la continuité de la domination. Il s'agit de challenger le complexe industriel carcéral, pas les bâtiments en tant que tels, mais bien les dynamiques économiques, politiques, qui ont fait qu'il apparaît aujourd'hui comme une solution face à des problèmes sociaux dont on pense qu'il y aurait des solutions meilleures.
The first thing I should say, because it seems always necessary, is that prison abolitionists do not believe that we will just leave everything in society the way it is now and open up the doors to the prisons. This, which inspires much fear in people, is a charge that's made against us with the belief that there isn't a larger vision attached to the abolition of prison. For us, the abolition of prison is a horizon that allows us to work together to think about what other ways we need to move in society to make it possible to end the use of incarceration. So the first work that we do in thinking about abolition feminism is to disarticulate crime from punishment. That is, to no longer operate as if punishment is a consequence of crime, And so therefore we should be focusing on talking endlessly about crime and who's committing crimes and who are the people who are being overcharged with crimes and who are the people who are being over-incarcerated, which is of course a very common indication that we need reform, but rather instead to focus on the end of the use of incarceration because it does not actually produce the results that it is ostensibly designed to produce.
Il est toujours nécessaire de rappeler que cet abolitionniste, ce féminisme abolitionniste, ne croit pas, ne pense pas qu'il s'agit de laisser la société comme elle est pour juste d'ouvrir les portes des prisons. Il s'agit justement de travailler ensemble pour réfléchir à quels autres besoins de transformation sont nécessaires pour rendre cet emprisonnement inutile. Une des premières tâches, c'est de désarticuler l'association qui est faite entre crime et punishment, punition. Puisqu'il ne s'agit pas de faire comme de vérifier si des personnes, des catégories de personnes sont plus pénalisées que d'autres, etc., puisque ça nous mènerait à une perspective de réformer le système carcéral, mais bien de partir du constat que ces emprisonnements ne produisent pas les effets, les résultats qu'ils sont supposés avoir.
Abolition feminism also proceeds from, as I mentioned just a moment ago, non-identitarian practices, but ones that are not afraid to mobilize identity. In this sense, they work from differences to produce differences that we do not yet know. This is not the same as thinking of equality as the reduction of all forms of difference to a version of the same. And it becomes then a challenge, potentially, and not always, to universalisms.
Comme je l'ai mentionné plus haut, ce féminisme abolitionniste repose sur une pratique non identitaire, mais qui n'est pas effrayé de mobiliser le concept d'identité. Il s'agit de travailler à partir de nos différences, non pas de penser l'égalité comme une réduction de ces différences, mais plutôt comme la possibilité de remettre en question une certaine conception de l'universel.
Abolition feminism also does not suggest that we would preserve the map of the prison industrial complex or what we sometimes call the footprint of the prison. Instead, we think of not lifting up that which we have now and removing it and putting something in the same place in the same order, but rather thinking about the different forms of life that would exist in the place the prison occupies today.
Il ne s'agit pas de dire qu'on regarde la carte des prisons et ce qu'elle pourrait laisser, mais de penser les formes de vie qui pourraient exister à la place des actuelles prisons.
And in particular, the issue of sexual violence has been critical to the elaboration of abolition feminism. As Angela pointed out already, it comes from a new definition of security. If security is not having more police on the street, then what is security? Sometimes, for example, especially when not speaking in the United States, I focus on water and security, which is a global feminist issue. Other times we focus on ways of managing what we call interpersonal violence while balancing attention to state violence. so that the solution to sexual violence then is not greater and greater incarceration, but rather an attempt to intervene in interpersonal violence and as well to reduce state violence. And of course, we have to make this difficult work because feminism has sometimes celebrated itself and measured its achievements by the extent to which it has been able to criminalize behavior that's considered violence against women. Even the very term violence against women has not been well thought through often in terms of the kind of people who are gathered under the category of women. And so abolition feminism searches for other ways to resolve the problems of interpersonal violence, though I should mention, just in case this is misunderstood, that it does not ignore interpersonal violence. It just not does not consider it an achievement that we have greater and greater incarceration on the basis of feminist demands.
La question des violences sexuelles nous mène également à penser à la définition de la sécurité. Qu'est-ce que c'est que la sécurité? Est-ce que c'est avoir plus de police? Au contraire, on peut réfléchir plutôt à des questions qui mettent en relation, par exemple, l'eau et la sécurité. Les différentes méthodes de management, de gestion qui font augmenter les violences interpersonnelles. La solution à la violence sexuelle n'est pas d'augmenter les incarcérations, mais plutôt d'intervenir au niveau des violences interpersonnelles et des violences d'État. Un certain féminisme a pu se féliciter de l'extension de la criminalisation des comportements impliquant une violence sexuelle. Et même le terme, l'expression phare de violence contre les femmes demande de s'interroger sur quelles sont les femmes qui sont prises en compte dans cette catégorie de femmes. Le féminisme abolitionniste veut plutôt essayer de trouver d'autres moyens de résoudre cette question des violences interpersonnelles. Et voilà.
But so the previous things that I've said are not controversial at all in the world of those who consider themselves involved in the work of abolition feminism. However, now I want to add a few features that are less well expressed and less dominant in this form of thinking. One aspect has to do with thinking, and now I'm returning to the question of universalisms, through indigenous feminisms and in terms of indigenous sovereignty. This has presented, I think, in organizing and in academic life, one of the most profound challenges to thinking about how to end the prison industrial complex. Because the end of the prison industrial complex does not always require thinking about the question of settler colonialism and other colonialisms. And because of this, it is often important to think not only about what kinds of reforms and what kinds of radical changes we need, but also in what temporalities are we operating? Where are we thinking? How are we thinking about land, for example? Angela already mentioned what's happening in terms of the activism currently in solidarity with the Sioux in the United States, but even to call the United States may be inappropriate in that instance. Again, this only demonstrates the very challenge it is to begin to think in these frameworks. This is why the particular relationship being developed in Black Lives Matter to the cause of Palestinians has been incredibly important and productive. It is the first time in quite a long time that there's been a version of internationalism inside of a young black movement in a way that seems quite distinct. It is, of course, only one example, not all examples, but especially for young people, it is quite different from the mode of activism that they've been exposed to in the past.
Une des nécessités, c'est également de penser à travers le féminisme indigène, le concept de souveraineté indigène, et de mettre en relation de comment penser ce complexe industriel carcéral en relation avec les questions du colonialisme. C'est important de penser pas pour se demander quel type de réforme, mais dans quelle temporalité il s'agit d'opérer. Comment on pense à la terre, notamment en ce moment, comme l'a mentionné Angela, avec la solidarité avec les Sioux, et penser dans le cadre d'un nouveau cadre qui soit véritablement radical. Notamment, on pense par exemple à la relation entre le mouvement Black Lives Matter et les mouvements palestiniens, qui a été très importante, qui a donné lieu à des choses très productives, qui a produit un internationalisme au sein d'un mouvement de jeunes noirs. Un internationalisme différent de ce qui a pu exister par le passé.
We also need to think about a shift in the forms of rationality, including ways of thinking through capitalist rationality. And I don't have time because of our translation to elucidate this further. However, I've been thinking quite a lot about this in the wake of the election of Donald Trump, because for many people, there was an inability to understand how we could be living in this counter-revolution of property. How, for example, I'm quoting, of course, the famous W.E.B. Du Bois as I say this, that I'm living through a moment which we did not expect could become, even if not a numerical majority, a threat to the multiple majority United States that we think that we are living in. And so the forms of neoliberal capitalist rationality are the ground for the production of an hegemony that many of us did not see.
Il faut également prendre en compte cette modification profonde au niveau des formes de rationalité, notamment comment penser dans le cadre de la rationalité capitaliste. C'est pas quelque chose que je vais avoir beaucoup le temps de développer ici, mais c'est quelque chose qu'on peut penser dans la foulée de l'élection de Trump. Et comment ces formes de rationalité néolibérale capitaliste sont le terrain des idéologies, sont le terrain qui ont produit ces idéologies qui aujourd'hui nous menacent.
I often spend more time explaining this next point, but I want to say quickly that abolition feminism also may require a shift in the notion of where we think the culture of the prison is. For example, in media and in everyday life, and you heard that I'm interested in popular culture, there is the conversation about prisons as if prisoners are the bearers of the culture of the prison. When there is research on prison, it's often been historically research on prisoners. When there is an interest in talking about what's happening on television or in movies, it's often about the ways in which prisoners represent what's happening inside of the prison. But instead, an abolition feminist perspective focuses on the culture of the prison as extending from the prison industrial complex, and therefore our attention is on state culture and not on the culture of the individuals who are currently inside.
Un autre changement important de cadre que suppose le féminisme abolitionniste, c'est si on regarde la manière dont dans la culture, dans les médias, lorsque la question de la prison est soulevée, les recherches, etc., portent sur les prisonniers. Au niveau du féminisme abolitionniste, il s'agit plutôt de réfléchir sur le complexe industriel carcéral, de s'interroger sur la culture de l'État et non plus de la culture des individus qui sont emprisonnés.
And the last thing that I would like to add to these questions is to suggest that we think in terms of secularity rather than secularism. And what I mean by that is that the broader term secularity refers to a relationship between a state and religious practice. But there are many secularisms. There are some secularisms that celebrate multiple religions, and there are other secularisms that extend from one dominant religion, and our relationship to these cannot be the same. We cannot analyze them in the same way, and they bear an important relationship to the questions we ask about culture and the state when we're talking about the prison industrial complex. For example, if national identity must be considered first for all subjects, and any relationship to other aspects of identity that precede national identity are perceived as threatening or challenging, then what do we have? If the mode of temporality of my own religious existence is inconsistent with the mode of temporality of state practice in the place where I live, what do we have to think? If, to use a term given to us through Heidegger and Edward Said, and finally Gayatri Spivak, the term worlding, which is not, as it's sometimes translated in terms of globalization, but really about the writing of the world in colonialism. I would like us to think also about another writing of the world. In other words, one of the reasons why some religions, and here I will only mention Islam, are perceived as threatening today has to do with the historical contingency invoked in the most frightening way, of course, by Samuel Huntington, as he referred to a clash of civilizations. I do not in any way invoke this to agree with Huntington's understanding of what civilization means or of what we should do about this clash, but I do invoke this notion of a clash because we do have a competition not between universalism and something outside of universalism, but of competing universalities, competing worldings of the world that sometimes coexist in one body. And how, then, should abolition feminism think of that?
Si l'identité ne doit pas être considérée en premier, la question, c'est justement si tout rapport ne suit pas cette identité, qu'est-ce qu'on a ? Si les modes de temporalité de notre existence sont religieuses, qu'est-ce qu'on doit penser ? Pour reprendre le terme de Heidegger, Said ou Spivak, de worlding, d'écriture du monde, quelle autre écriture du monde on peut proposer aujourd'hui, notamment par rapport à l'écriture du monde actuelle qui assimile la religion de l'islam à un danger, avec toute avec ce qui repose sur toute cette rhétorique du choc des civilisations. Alors, je ne suis pas d'accord avec cette théorie, mais j'utilise quand même je reprends quand même ce terme de choc pour parler de cette compétitivité universelle et de comment le féminisme abolitionniste peut penser cet enjeu.
From the standpoint of France, it might be tempting to see the US elections as confirmation that France is right about America. Although you have your elections, I know. But in the wake of our election, I think it's especially important for us to focus on forms of difference that are not so easily assimilated, not only by those that we think we are fighting, but also for ourselves. So abolition feminism must also be articulated to these aspects of suppression of difference and disappearing of specific differences, resisting forms of secularism that hide their forms of culture, resisting anti-racisms that only see one form of its expression, and resisting the complex but sometimes distracting interplay of identity categories in the social. Thank you.
Alors, je sais que du point de vue français, il est tentant de voir les élections américaines comme la confirmation de ce que la France pensait déjà des États-Unis. Bon, vous avez vos élections bientôt également. Il s'agit aussi de penser les formes de différence et notamment de mettre en place une forme de résistance par rapport au complexe carcéral qui agit également au niveau de la manière dont on va catégoriser les identités dans nos rapports sociaux. Merci.
Bien, il va être bientôt 20h52, bientôt 9h, mais on souhaitait quand même ouvrir la discussion, donner la parole à la salle. S'il vous plaît, faites des interventions, des questions courtes, qu'on puisse quand même échanger avec le plus de personnes possible. Je remercie Morgane Merteuil qui doit être fatiguée, c'est pas facile. Et vous avez compris que Angela et Gina comprennent le français, donc je pense qu'elles comprendront vos questions, sinon Morgane les aidera. Et on va essayer peut-être là de faire les choses, si vous le voulez bien. Seulement en anglais pour oui.
Bonsoir, moi je m'appelle Judith et je voudrais revenir sur les élections des femmes blanches aux États-Unis pour savoir si cette question s'adresse du coup à Angela, si tu as fait, tu as eu le temps de faire une analyse de cette population de femmes blanches qui ont voté pour Trump. Et je voulais savoir aussi, est-ce que ces femmes ont voté pour Trump parce qu'elles se sont beaucoup cristallisées sur sur le foulard et sur les fondamentalistes musulmans, ou il y a d'autres raisons. Voilà.
I think I'll answer in English. Thank you for the question. There are different ways to respond to that question as to, you know, why so many white women were seduced by the ideologies represented by Donald Trump. The first point I would make is that you know, oftentimes we treat gender as if it were a sign of absolute difference, a sign of political difference. But historically, that has not proved to be the case. When women received the vote in 1920, the argument around women's suffrage was that when women finally get the vote, the world will change. But as a matter of fact, there was very little difference in the outcome of, and I should point out that in 1920, women got the vote. Women got the vote. But it was not until 1965 that black women legally received the right to vote. With the passage of the Voting Rights Act. So that's one way I would answer your question. But I would also point out that I think there has been a failure of the left to develop analyses and to popularize analyses of neoliberalism and globalization that perhaps would have drawn more of those women and men as well to recognize that their predicament, their economic predicament especially, is a direct consequence of globalization, of deindustrialization of the economy, of the very processes that have allowed Donald Trump to become such a rich man. And so it seems to me that that's a very important element of the agenda for radical organizing during this period. And, you know, I mentioned the ways in which I think we have to recognize the feminization of the global labor force in my presentation. You know, but at the same time, it's important to recognize that we're still experiencing the consequences of the removal of major industries from the U.S. to parts of the world where the labor force is not organized into labor unions, and where therefore labor is cheaper. It's an indication also, it seems to me, that we have to consider transnational and international modes of organizing as well, because I don't think that those women recognized, they could not recognize themselves as a part of global communities that have been crushed by the rise of global capitalism.
I also have a question for Ms. Davis, if that's all right. I guess for me, one of the frustrating things, I'm also American, and I guess after the election, the frustrating part was looking at social media and seeing on Facebook all the articles. You know, it's easy to post an article about what we can do, and it's easy to sit there in front of the computer and click on buttons. And I guess in some ways I was wondering, you made a comment about it's not the moment to perhaps be giving up. And in some ways I'd like to know what you are doing concretely and what some of us may be able to do concretely as well in our daily lives. Because I guess one of the things for me that's been very hard is trying to reevaluate my life and what ways am I contributing to society to make it better, even though I might be this far away. And I thought maybe volunteering for Restos du Coeur might be one way for me to get involved in life now. But I do want to know also, what does that mean for us citizens, not just as Americans or around the world, to really start actively participating in political life? Because it's so easy for me to say, I'm not a politician. I don't want to be a politician. And to not get involved and then get angry or extremely devastated after these results. And it takes this result for me to realize that I can't sit at home anymore and go about my life every day anymore. And what does that mean concretely from someone like you who's been an activist your whole life, if that's all right?
Well, it's quite interesting to think about the intensity of the response to the election of Donald Trump, which is quite different from previous moments. In Florence, I was talking about the fact that I remember very clearly the election of Richard Nixon, which was absolutely a kind of counter-revolutionary response to the movements that emerged in the late 1960s and the early 70s. His election was not greeted with a kind of, with a sense of devastation that marked the collective response in the aftermath of the election of Donald Trump. And that is because I think that those of us who consider ourselves radical activists, revolutionaries even, did not necessarily treat electoral politics as the privileged space for the expression of politics, of radical politics. Our sense of connectedness was with revolutions that were happening in other parts of the world. And so, you know, of course, we were reading Frantz Fanon, and we were, you know, we were reading Che Guevara and Amilcar Cabral. And so our sense of where the world was headed was not so contained within the nation, but rather had to do with global, you know, revolutionary movements. And so this, I think, is a sense of the extent to which the nation has become has created the parameters of a sense of community. And I think this is a period where we have to really begin to contest the value of nationalism, the value of the nation as our primary mode of community. And of course, there's activism. And I would say that, and you know, I've been that kind of a person all of my life. And as someone who has spent many decades involved in many different kinds of activisms, if I were to offer any advice at all, I would suggest that that you seek out the kind of activism about which you are passionate. I don't think you should, you know, volunteer for something just because you think that this is what the moment requires. You should find a way to give expression to your own individuality. And I say this because I think that that neoliberalism has caused us to fold in upon ourselves as individuals, and we cannot make the distinction between individuality and individualism. And I think that individuality is best expressed in community. The only possible way to extricate ourselves from this situation is by intensely building community, a sense of community, but through the ways in which you think that you are most fulfilled. And I don't know anything about you. I don't know whether you would prefer, sitting in meetings all night long and doing that kind of work, or whether you would prefer writing poetry and sharing that with your community. I think it's becoming increasingly evident that ways of building a community must allow people to give expression to their aesthetic desires as well, and that the modes of politicization that take this into consideration through poetry, through music, through visual art, are far more lasting than the ones that simply try to impose certain analyses on people who may, like Donald Trump, transform if Donald Trump was a Democrat, right? And not that long ago. So we need a sense of community that is going to create a more permanent, but at the same time, a community that it attends to difference, that sees, as Audre Lorde pointed out, difference as and contradiction precisely as the spark of creativity.
Je vais parler en français parce que mon anglais n'est pas terrible. Moi, la question que je me pose, c'est nous ici en France, on a presque les mêmes problèmes qu'aux États-Unis. La discrimination est intense. Bien sûr qu'on peut faire des choses individuellement, mais il y a un moment où on a besoin du collectif. Or, il n'y a plus de collectif aujourd'hui. Alors, je fais un constat un peu sombre parce que c'est assez déprimant. Mais la question est comment créer du collectif avec... Enfin, j'ai parlé de moi. Enfin, moi, je suis une fille de la deuxième génération d'immigrés, comme on dit. Voilà, métissage des Antilles, d'Algérie, etc. J'ai l'impression d'avoir fauté. C'est-à-dire que quand je vois un documentaire sur des jeunes Français de banlieue qui ne connaissent pas des Français, parce qu'ils ne vivent qu'avec des Noirs et des Arabes, enfin, je suis émue, je suis désolée, je suis très émue, on a raté quelque chose. Et je me sens très coupable de ça. Je fais partie des gens qui ont milité dans le cadre de la marche des beurs, etc. On a beaucoup milité quand on était plus jeunes, et aujourd'hui, on se sent, enfin moi en tous les cas, je suis désolée de parler en mon nom personnel, mais c'est ainsi que je le ressens, je me sens démunie aujourd'hui. Et si grâce à mon travail, je peux intervenir, que ce soit en prison ou ailleurs, j'ai l'impression de faire des petites actions, mais que c'est ridicule face à l'immensité des choses. Enfin, c'est un constat, peut-être un peu... Alors, je ne sais pas comment adapter ici, en France, un mouvement collectif qui permettrait effectivement qu'on... Enfin, peut-être que c'est... Je ne sais pas, il y a un côté révolutionnaire dans tout ça, mais je ne crois même pas. Enfin, là, il faut sauver nos vies, parce que c'est des vies qu'il faut sauver. Dans les banlieues, ce sont des gamins qui vont faire des études et qui ne vont pas trouver d'emploi. C'est la discrimination du logement. C'est plein de choses comme ça qui sont insupportables, insupportables. Et je me dis qu'on a raté un virage tellement important. Et nous, on va avoir prochainement des élections qui vont être, je pense, assez terribles. Voilà, je ne vous demande pas une solution. Hein.
Okay, I have a question for you. question.
Oh, okay.
Est-ce qu'il y a d'autres personnes avec des questions? Parce que ce sera la dernière. Venez, me poser votre question. Comme ça, on va. Il y a une autre personne ou deux. Après, ça, on va fermer.
Hello. I have a question for Angela. It's not an unbiased question because I'm a small business owner. I have a small vegan restaurant. And
where is it?
It's in the 17th in the Batignolles area. It's right next to Park Martin Luther King.
We're just looking for a vegan restaurant this morning and went to really? Le Grenier de Notre-Dame and it was closed.
Oh, really?
Yes.
My restaurant's called My Kitchen. Very easy to remember. And my question is, because you talked about freedom and stability, and food stability is a very important political question when it comes to peace on earth. And what is for you the role of veganism in food stability? Because I know you're vegan, and I know you don't talk about it very often, but I want to ask you, why are you vegan?
Okay. All right.
Last question, okay. We agree.
Do you want to... I just didn't want
to... Okay. Bonjour. Donc je pose ma question en français, vous comprenez aussi. Je me demandais si avec l'élection récente aux États-Unis, vous trouvez que vos combats vont prendre une nouvelle nature ou si en réalité vous allez combattre quelque chose qui est un peu de la même nature que ce que l'establishment du Parti démocrate aurait proposé. Certains le qualifient de suprématie blanche light. Donc quelle est votre position sur ça? Est-ce que vos combats seront complètement différents parce que Trump a quand même nommé des personnes qui sont ouvertement suprémacistes blanches à son futur cabinet? Ou est-ce que finalement, ce sera peut-être juste une question d'intensité, mais que c'est de la même nature que l'establishment du Parti démocrate? Voilà.
Thank you. I have a question about Bernie Sanders. You mentioned Bernie Sanders, and one thing I think that is not, perhaps not mentioned enough, and perhaps you might say a few words on that, either of you, is the fact that Martin Luther King, Reverend Martin Luther King, was assassinated shortly after he brought together, he wanted to bring together poor people of all races and turn the movement towards dealing with class as much as race, or class and race at the same time. Don't you think that Bernie Sanders here, and this could maybe be the silver lining of this election, is that he has brought race, brought class to the fore in the discussion? And I think he, if I can defend him a bit, I think that he did have surrogates who were taking care of the race issue, where maybe he could have, maybe he was a little bit lacking in experience on that. Okay.
Okay, okay, good. So I think what we're going to do is try to address the questions and at the same time make some closing comments. So Gina will follow. And I see four different questions. With respect to the first question, where are you? There are many local forms of organizing in France, in Paris, in the banlieue. And it seems to me that those local forms of organizing should be supported. In a sense, the marginalization of the banlieue and the joblessness and the problems with the schools and all of those issues should be centralized This is something that not only the inhabitants of the banlieue should be concerned with, but all of the progressive people in France should say, these should be our major issues. And I, you know, I found it, I should say, very, very disappointing when, as a response to the horrendous acts of violence that have happened here over the last period, as a response to that, there was, you know, simply greater modes of security, the loi sur les renseignements. And certainly, if you look at our experience in the U.S., you know that that is not the solution. We're living with the consequences of the Patriot Act, and certainly the new administration of Donald Trump is going to take advantage of that. So I would, you know, this is how to arrive at new universalisms, new, you know, ways of considering what the most important problems are here in France. The question regarding veganism, and thank you, and I wish I had time to eat at your restaurant, because I've been looking for vegan restaurants in Paris for many, many years, and have found a few. Well, you know, I think that probably the best way to address a decision to not eat meat, I'm reluctant to be a proselytizer. But I do believe that, particularly during this era of global capitalism, where our food is produced by technologies of capitalist industrialization in ways that violate the earth and pollute the earth and create untold pain for animals that are simply reared in order to provide nourishment for human beings, and most often that nourishment does not even make human beings healthy. As a matter of fact, I was looking at the McDonald's down the street on Boulevard Saint-Germain, right?
Sorry about that.
I'm... But when one considers that the ways of producing and preparing food are responsible in this era for so much disease. In Oakland, there was a, in California, there was a measure on the ballot that taxed sweet drinks and, you know, Coca-Cola and, you know, all of those drinks that have caused 8-year-old children to get type 2 diabetes. My own trajectory towards veganism is kind of bizarre, because I stopped eating meat when I was in jail. But that was because the meat they were serving was old and it had maggots, and it was a way of, you know, protesting. But in you know, over the years, I've become conscious of the importance of conscious eating. And I suppose I would say that it is a version of an understanding of the relationships, the relations that are inherent in the commodity, and, you know, for those of you who have, you know, read Karl Marx, and particularly the fetishism of commodities, you understand what I'm talking about. That, you know, commodities, as commodities, conceal the human relations, the labor relations that are embodied in these objects, so that we think about how the exchange value or how much something costs, rather than how these objects actually place us in relation to workers who have produced these things that we use. And I think we have to create a similar relationship to the food that we eat. We have to ask ourselves, where does this come from? What were the conditions of production? What are the violences that are inherent in the food that I'm eating? I think that food sovereignty is going to be one of the major global struggles of the future, and particularly with the colonization of the planet by corporations like Monsanto. We are going to have to think very differently about food and the preservation of the planet and biodiversity. The third question about, I guess we have to begin thinking about the Donald Trump administration. And from what we're seeing now, there will be no attempt to develop compromises with the population that is so opposed to his election. And I think it's going to mean that we have to create alternative sites of expressing ourselves politically. There was maybe Gina will talk about the op-ed in the New York Times by Charles Blow, which was a very radical position. We will. And in a sense, it was saying that there are those of us who will become ungovernable, that we will not allow Donald Trump to simply become the 45th president of the United States of America. And so I think we're getting ready for a period of struggle that hopefully will inspire people to stand up and say no to capitalism, to racism, to homophobia, and to all of these modes of domination. And Bernie Sanders, I kind of like Bernie Sanders. I just kept wishing that his analysis a little more complex. I think it was the simplicity of the analysis that didn't quite resonate. And he had the surrogates. Yeah, he had a lot of surrogates and good friends of mine, Danny Glover and Harry Belafonte, and they were explaining why it would have been more important to elect Bernie Sanders, and that. I agree, but at the same time, we can't assume that all we need to do is bring down Wall Street, and then we will experience utopia. I think the experience in South Africa warns us that we really have to begin to imagine the life we want to live and to talk about it. Even though we may never actually experience that, and I want to riff for my last moment on the point that Gina made about new temporalities. Temporalities that reflect a different relationship to the earth, a different relationship to history, a different relationship to the future. And You know, I don't know whether it's because I've grown older, but I have become less concerned with only with what happens in my lifetime. And I think that that neoliberalism encourages us to measure time in relation to our individual selves. And so what does it mean to recognize that the work we do today will help to usher in a new world that we may never individually witness, but we will be present. You know, just as those who struggled before are present in the ways in which we evoke them and evoke the transformations, that we will have a spiritual present in that future that we are dreaming, that may not exactly correspond to the way we are dreaming it now, but that will certainly be ushered into being as a result of the work we do today.
So it will take too long to answer all four questions in the same order, so I'm just going to say a few brief things. Angela mentioned the New York Times piece by Charles Blow, who's a Black American who has been writing very important pieces. And I'll just tell you the title in case the title signals what he's doing. He says, "No Trump, we can't all get along." Quoting what you might remember from Rodney King when he said, he asked the question after he had been beaten and there was so much turmoil in the wake of that, can't we all just get along? So Charles Blow's saying, no, we can't. I have to say that I know many people came here because they mostly wanted to ask questions to Angela and wanted to see her, and I know that every time we're in France, that's very important, and I respect that. I do want to say, though, that I also, I didn't maybe connect explicitly to the question, for example, about the young people in the banlieue and the situations in France, that for me, this question of carcerality is not only an American question, and certainly when we've spent time here in various neighborhoods in the larger Paris, this question comes up intensely. And so it's really important, I think, for us to be speaking of this and for everyone here to know that the form of abolition feminism I was describing is also really about these encounters as well and these spaces we've been in, where sometimes there are very difficult questions about the relationship of different people living in those same communities, those, for example, of West African descent living under a certain kind of colonialism, those, for example, as you mentioned, from the Caribbean, those who are Arab, who have very different relationships to the current their current existence in Paris. And so in a sense, I think sometimes their new experiences are means of creating connections that they wouldn't have had, just as post-Trump there are communities for us that are speaking with each other again in different ways than they have in recent moments. So I think that's one way of being optimistic about it. I want to say a little about white supremacy light. I don't know how light it's going to turn out, but I think maybe one point here is to say that it is maybe not light, but it is reality TV white supremacism. That is, it's not. Some people have said that it doesn't have a relationship to truth or to facts. People say facts, but it's actually not interested in truth. I think that's actually a more precise way of saying it, that that the references are all in the realm of signs and signifying, and that actually it might not turn out to feel light, but it looks light because it doesn't actually say many of the things that some of the actual white nationalists and white supremacists have been saying before and in the wake of the election. And so being able to talk about that, being able to talk about why we had Reagan as the film star and now we have Donald Trump as the reality TV star, and I don't believe, given my work, that that's accidental at all. It didn't really matter ever what he said for anyone. And it also meant that the entire conversation, even from the other side, was then focused only on the battling and the sort of notion of whether or not we live in a fact-based universe or not. As a literary scholar, I'm always suspicious of the invocation of facts. And in the wake of the election, I'm not sure that facts will save us. So I'm interested in, here I'm looking at Subic Glissant, and I'm thinking about the philosophie de la liberation and of other ways of being together, which sometimes occur even in the same being. And I think those are ways that we have to lift up in this moment against the tyranny of facticity meeting the tyranny of the white supremacy light.